Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, here with Russ Chianelli as a co-host, and today we're going to be talking to a stress neurobiologist. You may say, what on earth is a stress neurobiologist? Well, you know what stress is, you know what neurobiology is, put the two together, one causes the other, perhaps, to have problems. Russ, who's our guest?
We're very happy to have with us today on Science Studio Professor Lawrence Regan. He's from the Department of Pharmacology, Physiology, and Neuroscience at the University of South Carolina Medical School. Welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much.
That's quite a mouthful, Russell. Well
done.
Yes,
it is.
Larry, before, if I can call you Larry.
Of course.
Yeah. Before we get into, you know, what you're exactly doing now and what the sort of significance of that sort of research and science is, a little bit about yourself. You know, our audience always sort of likes to think, you know, well, how did this fellow begin into such a bizarre occupation? So what were the beginnings of you being a scientist?
So I have the beginnings of my science, which, you know, are sort of romanticized by a lot of people in terms of, well, I had a certain teacher that guided me towards science. And that's actually the case for me. I had a biology teacher in my sophomore year of high school who really guided me towards and sort of planted the seed in me, this love for biology. And so from there, and this was very odd for me because everyone in my family were business people. And so when I came home and announced as a young lad in high school that I was going to become a biologist and go to medical school and study biology and then, you know, hopefully someday become a professor, that was met with shock and skepticism by my family full of accountants and business people. So from that point, I started working towards that goal. Went to an undergraduate institution very similar to UTEP, which focused on a really strong biology department. And then at that time, I had an opportunity to sort of serendipity intervened. So my sister had a very good friend whose husband was a faculty member at the veterinary school at the University of Pennsylvania. And so he offered me an opportunity to come and work in his lab one summer. And as we say, the rest is history. Yeah. And completed my PhD work at the University of Pennsylvania and then went to the Rockefeller University in New York to study in Bruce McEwen's lab, who is one of the, I guess, leaders in stress neurobiology, and from which sort of helped shape the type of work that I'm doing right now.
So back up a little bit in New York, because that was an interesting time, which you're talking about.
Well, it was an interesting time for me because I went into, you know, Rockefeller is a very interesting and unique place because it's mostly a research institute. There's no undergraduates. There's a small graduate program. But so the real focus is on training of fellows and performing top-notch, internationally recognized research. The faculty there is full of Nobel laureates and members of the National Academy. And so it was a great opportunity for me to interact with the leaders in the field of every discipline in science. And so it was a really rich time for me in terms of developing my skills as a scientist, both at the bench and beyond the bench.
Were you intimidated a little bit to go there right from school?
I was very intimidated. And also the impact of moving to New York City, even though I grew up in Philadelphia, that's a big jump. I mean, New York is an international city. And sort of as an interesting anecdote, the first day that we were there, when I was returning the rental truck at 5 o'clock at night in Harlem, I ran over a police car. So into the U-Haul parking lot, right over a police car. So that was a very interesting introduction.
It must have been a very big truck or a very small police car.
It was both. So it was a very interesting introduction to New York City.
What year was that? I knew a lot of people at Rockefeller University because I'm from New York City.
Okay, so that was in January of 1996 that I started at Rockefeller.
Pretty recent.
Yes, okay. And we were there until August of 2002. So it was an interesting time in terms of, again, developing certain skill sets as it relates to stress neurobiology and developing a scientific network because of the mentor that I worked with. But beyond that, there was, you know, firsthand life experiences as it relates to the effects of stress, the effects of a traumatic, stressful event as it relates to the events of September 11th.
Let's talk about that a little, okay? So neuroscience is the sort of the big umbrella, and that's relatively a new sort of field. I mean, we're actually, you know, we've always been able to put certain electrodes and see where things happen. But understanding what we were seeing is relatively new. And so the impact of stress, which is also a relatively new concept, to put the two together, you're in a very frontier area at the moment. So why don't you back off and tell us, in your quick definition, neuroscience and then how that leads to neurobiology and then stress neurobiology.
Well, how long do we have?
You've got 2 minutes to do that, right? And then we'll get into what you really do.
Okay, so I think that in terms of the broader impacts of stress, I mean, we can think of in response to, say, an acute stressful event. Most often, those types of responses to an acute stressful event are adaptive. You know, we think of the classic fight or flight response that helps the organism to survive and respond appropriately to those sorts of stimuli. On the other hand, what we have is situations in response to chronic stress in which someone may, for example, perfect example is caregiver stress, the stress associated with taking care of a loved one who might have a chronic disorder. That's an incredible social stressor on an individual, which has profound effects on neurobiology, ranging from everything from how neurons talk to one another to the shape and structure of neurons all the way to cognitive function. Stress isn't always a bad thing. In many ways, stress in an acute setting could be very good.
Save your life.
It could save your life.
It gets you tenure. I mean,
that
you see people who really, you know, in their last 2 years of their tenure track, really are stressed.
Right.
But they're actually then putting out far better than that first year. Okay?
Getting
perhaps
out of Harlem after you run over the police car.
Exactly right. So I think that now that's fundamentally different from what we think about in terms of something which is very relevant to your audience and relevant to an audience back home for me, because we have a huge boot camp base there, Fort Jackson in Columbia, is post-traumatic stress disorder. And now you have an acute stressful event. And under those circumstances, if you have a troop of soldiers out, some of them will develop post-traumatic stress disorder, maybe about 30 or 35% in response to this acute traumatic stressful event, whereas the rest of them will not. So in that situation, now we're talking about pathology associated with an acute event. And so now we get back to this discussion about, well, what is it? What are those underlying factors which contribute to that vulnerability, so to speak, of having a deleterious response to a stress event?
So do we know what separates these?
And that's exactly what we're looking for. That's sort of the magic bullet that everyone's looking for, and no pun intended, in terms of is that identifying what is a missing factor or probably a constellation of factors which predisposes individuals to developing post-traumatic stress disorder. And this is obviously not just related to military folks, but obviously it's a major focus today. But obviously anyone who's exposed to a traumatic event, you know, sexual abuse, child abuse, things of that sort of nature, which has lifelong consequences.
We did a program recently with the chair of neuroscience in Michigan, and one of his directions is to look for some genetic feature there. I mean, by looking at the genome of people who have suffered and others who have not,
right?
And one of the things that I took out of that is that, okay, you can suffer a traumatic thing today, and it may lay dormant for a long time until some trigger that either reminds your brain or you, whichever, I suppose that's the same thing, that you then relapse into some really nasty situation.
That's exactly right. And especially for the kids who are coming back from overseas who are experiencing traumatic events, there is a trigger event which will reinforce the symptoms and the pathology of post-traumatic stress disorder. So that's what makes it so challenging. And from the clinical perspective, what makes it so challenging is we don't know what those factors are. And if we could identify what those factors are, that would at least put us in the right direction of potentially developing effective strategies to treat the military kids or whichever individuals might have PTSD.
I remember a friend of mine when I was in high school coming back from Vietnam, and we were camping or something, and we all noticed that when he was sleeping, he was reaching under the bed for his gun. Mm-hmm. I said, what are you doing? And then he didn't really know where he was.
Right. I think that that would be a good indication of the type of symptoms that someone might experience or exhibit who has post-traumatic stress disorder is reliving that event. And so right now, one of the most effective strategies for treating PTSD is sort of these cognitive behavioral training in terms of helping individuals recognize
what
those types of behaviors and how they can deal with them appropriately. And similar to what we see in a wide variety of neurological disorders is cognitive behavioral training is a really big factor in effectively managing the disorder. And another big factor as well is having a really good support network and that friends and family that can provide support in terms of emotional support for the individuals. And we were talking a little bit about, in terms of neurochemistry, the types of neurochemicals that are involved in these stress-related neurological disorders. It seems as if there's probably, at least the emerging data would suggest that there's a whole host of neurochemicals that are involved. And I think that if you look at the neurobiology, especially as it relates to depression, the particular drugs that we use to treat depression, let's keep in mind, they immediately restore the appropriate levels of neurotransmitters in the brain. They act immediately to do that, but they don't produce immediate effects in patients. And I think the reason for that is, and a lot of literature would suggest this, that disorders like depression don't develop overnight. They develop over long periods of time. And so you have changes in the entire milieu of the central nervous system. The infrastructure of the brain changes. And so one component of that is the neurochemistry. And some would say that the neurochemistry is driving those other changes in the brain. But one of the things you need to keep in mind is, because it takes such a long time to develop those changes in neuronal infrastructure, it's going to take an equal amount of time to hopefully bring it back to what you would want to see it in a control individual or a healthy individual. So that's why even with someone with depressive illness, you can almost immediately restore neurochemistry to what you would expect. But the problem is, because of those other types of changes that you see, changes in the structure of neurons and things of that nature, that it's going to take several weeks to maybe even months before a patient actually gets better.
Well, why is it that post-traumatic syndrome is sort of relatively a modern condition? I mean, obviously we've been going to war forever and ever. Mm-hmm. Was it just not recognized and sort of swept away as...
Right, and so exactly that was a question I get a lot when I give these public forum type talks. And my feeling is, and again, this is not based on my personal experience, and I think that we hear soldiers from World War II when they talk about their recollections. It's often described as, oh, well, he had shell shock. Or, well, yeah, you know, Uncle John was in the war, but he doesn't talk about it. And so I think a lot of time those individuals did have post-traumatic stress disorder, but it was something that was not discussed.
Shell shock.
Right. It was not discussed. And so I think that what we're seeing now is that there's a greater understanding and appreciation that this is a neurobiological disorder. And so I think that part of it is that maybe back in the day there was sort of a stigma associated with that. And whereas now there's not so much of the stigma associated with it.
Have either one of you seen Paths to Glory? Kirk Douglas, I think. And it's about this trench warfare in World War One, and what happens is they're ordered to charge, even though, you know, up this hill and all that.
Over the top,
and some of them don't go. And the commander ordered the guns to fire back on their own trenches in his whole story. And what they wound up doing was executing 1 out of 10. And you could imagine that was probably the worst syndrome, shell shock you could imagine.
Right, right.
Well, there's going to be a shock right now because we're going to interrupt the program for a station break. We'll be back in one moment. You're listening to Science Studio. Just hang in there. We'll be back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. I can tolerate reading glasses. What I'm afraid of is developing a degenerative eye disease like many older Americans and eventually losing my sight.
Degenerative eye diseases that lead to blindness are caused by the death of photoreceptor cells, which are nerve cells in the retina that allow us to see.
For years, scientists have experimented with ways to repair or replace these cells. And finally, in a recent landmark study, researchers transplanted immature photoreceptor cells in mice and restored their vision.
They first engineered mice with rods that didn't work. Rods and cones are two types of photoreceptor nerve cells. These cells convert light energy into signals that travel the optic nerve to the brain. Cones detect color and detail, while rods pick up black and white, peripheral, and low-light vision.
In these mice with non-working rods, researchers injected their retinas with immature rod receptor cells from young, healthy mice. Within 4 to 6 weeks, 1 in 6 of these transplanted rod precursor cells were close to functioning normally. They formed nerve connections and generated signals that were transmitted to the brain for visual processing.
This is the first time transplanted photoreceptor cells have been shown to integrate into the circuitry of the retina and improve vision. To test the results, researchers placed treated mice and diseased mice into a dimly lit water maze.
The treated mice with new rods could see well enough in low light to find a platform and climb out.
Researchers say the study's success was due to the large number of photoreceptor cells they implanted. A clinical trial is already underway.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries are shaping the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Larry Regan from the University of South Carolina, a stress neurobiologist. And you were talking about shell shock. Is it also possible that now we pay so much attention to it and there's such a focus on it that people begin to know, oh, I'm suffering from this, and therefore continue to suffer from it, as opposed to not understanding there's an issue and getting on with their life? I mean, that sounds very
Yeah, very putting it behind you and not talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, is there any truth to that? If you don't recognize you've got a problem, sooner or later you don't have a problem? Or
well,
am I naive and stupid?
No, I think that the disentangling those sorts of issues is really important. And I think from not so much from, say, the science perspective, but maybe the epidemiological side of things, that's a real big issue right now, which epidemiologists are trying to identify. And I don't really think that when you talk about any neurobiological disorder, that it's one of those things, well, if I just don't think about it, I'm going to get better. Because fundamentally, the biology of the brain has changed. And so because of that
– But it can change again.
But it can change again. But I think without some sort of intervention, it would be very difficult for it to change again. I mean, maybe there are some individuals that can, by living those symptoms or trying to deal with those symptoms effectively on their own, that there are some individuals who can overcome that. But I think that in most situations, you're going to need some sort of intervention, even if it's the individual themselves recognizing that I have a problem and I need to come up with a strategy to deal with
that. To
cope with it. Exactly. And in coping mechanisms, I think, is big. Absolutely.
So how do we treat this now? What is a standard procedure?
So standard procedure is just sort of not to be flippant, but a lot of times it's just throwing a dart at a board. So a lot of times there'll be use of certain types of antidepressants, which have some effectiveness but generally are not effective. Drugs like lithium, which are used in the treatment of bipolar disorder, have shown some signs of success. But one of the big things now is this real push by agencies like the National Institutes of Health or the Veterans Administration or the Department of Defense to identify what we refer to as biomarkers, easily accessible markers, preferably in the plasma, which would give us an idea of what changes might be taking place in the central nervous system. And in theory, if you could identify a biomarker which is consistent across a wide variety of patients, then you can say, maybe this is the system that we need to target. And if we can target that system, maybe we can effectively manage this disease.
And I mean, going on to that, I mean, most of the studies are done on animals and mammals because mammalian neuroscience is very similar to ours. Mm-hmm. And in fact, this elephant, Korean elephant, that's being able to talk to its Korean master, I suppose, the man, and they say it's a stress response because it grew up without any other elephants. The only person it could communicate with was a man, and so it's learning to speak to them. You know, and I know all sorts of dog owners that sort of only talk to dogs, and it's ridiculous.
But I think you're absolutely right. And most diseases, that's a situation where you're looking at changes after the fact. But when you're talking about a situation like PTSD, you actually have a really unique opportunity. Because if you think about the kids who are right here at this base who are about to be deployed, you could do a whole host of peripheral markers. You could take blood. You can do neurocognitive testing.
Right.
No, you do all of them. You do all of the kids.
No, but I mean, and then after that, you select the ones that are more susceptible.
Well, when they come back, you still do all of them again.
Yeah.
Because now what you've got is a baseline measure of a soldier before they were deployed. And then you have the opportunity when they come back to see what changes might have taken place. And in fact, those are the types of studies which are going on right now. And it's a really unique opportunity to identify what those biomarkers might be.
And one of the responses to stress, I gather, is eating. Mm-hmm. And eating leads to obesity. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're doing in the area of obesity?
So one of the areas that we're interested in is, and we're talking again about stress-related disorders, and they're very comorbid, meaning that they seem to cluster together. So oftentimes with something like depressive illness, you see comorbid cardiovascular disease. And another example is, for example, one of the things that we're working on is in obese individuals, they seem to have a higher risk of developing depressive illness. So again, you get this clustering of disorders, these comorbidities.
So the way you state that is the obesity comes first and then followed by the depression as opposed to necessarily the other way around.
No, actually, it's a bidirectional relationship. Okay, studies have shown that individuals who
become,
have depression
put on weight when you're more depressed.
Right, or it can be that the initiating factor is the obesity, which leads to depression. So it's a bidirectional relationship. And the particular studies that we're working on is we're obviously interested in both directions, but the direction that we're interested in is under circumstances in which you have an obese individual, what are the driving factors which lead to the development of depressive illness? And so those are the sorts of things that we're working on right now. And again, looking at the underlying neurochemical responses. And unlike someone who has depressive illness who is not obese, it seems as if one of the major factors which increases the risk for developing depression in an obese individual are the changes in the metabolic milieu. So in terms of the types of things that we think about with type 2 diabetes in terms of individuals who have insulin resistance, they have changes in their lipid profiles, things of that nature, the hallmark features associated with type 2 diabetes, those seem to be some of the factors which may now, those signals getting into the central nervous system may increase the risk for the development of depressive illness.
Can you tell us a little bit how you do this research? You know, you're talking to two chemists here and we just pour together flasks and things like that.
So in the studies that I'm working on, we're working in obese animals. So we all of our studies are done in rats. The great advantage...
So you had to create the obesity.
Right. So we create the obese phenotype in these animals. And again, one of the advantages of these types of studies is now you have a great baseline in all of your subjects that you're working with. And you obviously have certain types of control animals, and then you have your obese animals, and then you can study the behavior of those animals. And again, let's be realistic, a neurological disorder like depressive illness, which is very complex, can't be mimicked in an animal. But we have certain types of behavioral tests.
Do we know whether the animals can get depressed?
Well, right, exactly. I mean, we don't have that component, but the animals do exhibit certain types of behaviors that are suggestive of a depressive illness phenotype. So, for example, they might not engage in the normal types of pleasurable activities that they would normally engage in if they didn't have this depressive illness phenotype. One of the ways that we measure that is their ability to take sucrose in. So if you provide them a choice between water and sucrose, a normal rat, a control animal, will love sucrose. They would prefer to drink more sucrose than they would water. But these in these experimental models of depression, those animals won't drink the sucrose. They'll drink more water than they will sucrose, which is indicative of sort of what we refer to as anhedonia, which is a classic feature associated with depressive illness, is that individuals don't normally engage anymore in the types of activities that they find pleasurable, their hobbies or things like that.
So wait a minute. So you're saying that people with obesity and depression will in fact avoid soft drinks? I mean, that seems counterintuitive. They're going to get slimmer and slimmer and they're saved.
Exactly. And I know that's one of the caveats associated with the things that we're working on. But on the flip side, what we've also seen in these animals is just like in humans, in our obesity phenotypes, these animals eat more food. So while they eat more of their standard food that they get, in this situation, this particular example, they have a decreased desire to seek something which they normally find pleasurable. Okay.
All right.
So what that provides us an opportunity to do is study the behavior, and then beyond the behavior, go in after the fact and study the neurobiology in terms of changes in, say, brain neurochemistry or changes.
I mean, what are you actually measuring there when you say neurobiology? You take a sample and you look for?
So, and for example, one of the things that we can look at is the structure of neurons. Okay, so we can see, has the structure of these neurons changed? And if the structure of neurons has changed, that might tell us that their ability to communicate might not be as effective. So another way that you can measure it is through certain types of electrophysiological techniques in which you can actually measure the synaptic connection, the communication between neurons.
And all this takes place in the hippocampus?
And well, one area that we're focusing on is in the hippocampus, but obviously there are many brain regions that are involved in these types of behaviors. So one of the things that we're thinking about is that the way that neurons, the structure of neurons, the way that neurons could communicate with one another, all of those types of changes are underlying what might be happening in terms of this comorbid obesity and depressive illness. And so what we're trying to identify is, out of that whole metabolic milieu, which changes, or is there a particular factor which seems to be the keystone in terms of really driving the neurobiology? And if we can identify what that keystone is, then perhaps what we can do is effectively treat that.
But if there isn't, and I think most of us would probably think it's so many things going on, it's like a chemical reaction.
Absolutely.
I think we know exactly the ingredient that's important. But when you purify that ingredient, the reaction doesn't work. So
absolutely.
In fact, there's just tiny little things, catalysts, stimulants. So if you come to the conclusion after a few years that there is no key feature, where does that put you?
So if you look at – obviously pharmacology is one thing. But if you look at lifestyle interventions, so diet and exercise. So we've done a series of studies where we've shown that if we mildly food deprive our animals – in such a way that it's not a stressor to the animals. And basically what we do is we return, in our obese animals, we return their body weight and their body composition and their whole metabolic milieu back to what you would see in a control animal. You can reverse all of those deficits that we see in hippocampus, including the behavioral deficits. So just that in and of itself tells us that you can reverse this phenotype, okay, by a intervention that all of us can do, which is just watch our diet. And another obvious way to do it is exercise.
Yeah.
And exercise has really positive effects.
The same
effects.
Old story.
Yes.
We've all heard it so many times.
Of course.
Times. Let's change subject. I want to get into something that's, I think, important. The role of government in this whole business of healthcare in terms of giving information to people. I mean, okay, so Bloomberg wanted to cut out these enormous Coca-Colas and Pepsis and all these other things. You know, and then there's this drive to make all restaurants, you know, put the calorific content of their food. And some people say, why is the government doing this? I would like to hear your take on that as an expert.
Well, you put me on the spot here with that. So I think that I try not to get involved in political debates too much, especially since, you know, the NIH is supporting our funding and that sort of thing. But I think that there is a role for government to play in these sorts of issues, because the role of the National Institutes of Health is to promote health in the United States. And so if that component, the scientific component of the federal government, namely the NIH or Veterans Affairs or things of that nature, or the National Science Foundation, their role is to promote health in the United States. And another component of that is, in terms of the government, is at least making individuals aware of what particular things might be in foods or caloric intake or those sorts of things. I think that's a really big, important component of it as well. Now, in terms of legislating, like, for example, in New York City, what may or may not be available, I'm not sure how I feel about that. But I also think that it's really important for those, for the consumer and individuals, to be aware of those sorts of things.
Right.
But again, the other thing to keep in mind is that in some way the government does have a role to play for that, because the obesity epidemic in this country has a profound socioeconomic impact in terms of healthcare costs. So in some ways, it's sort of a perhaps – not a very likable one, but perhaps it's an ounce of prevention for a pound of cure. Well, yeah. I'll just make one other comment. We were talking about, obviously, beyond lifestyle interventions, which obviously we know are not going to be 100% effective all the time. The classic example is bariatric surgery. And so, and with these gastric bypass surgeries, in many individuals, it will almost immediately reverse their type 2 diabetes phenotype.
Yes.
And those individuals are able to take off weight and maintain that decrease in body weight for long periods of time. However, there's also a population of those patients which undergo bariatric surgery, which over time, their body weight will creep back up and return back to where it was prior to surgery. And so the question is, why? Why are those individuals in which you've had a very invasive intervention, namely a bypass surgery, that it's very effective for them, but patient B, it's less effective? And I think, again, what that goes into is there's always going to be this gene-environment interaction. It's going to be patient-to-patient variability. So for some people, therapeutic intervention is the only way this is going to work. And the problem is that we don't know the best target right now.
But that's what your research is going
on. That's what
a lot of NIH funding goes towards solving.
Yes, hey. Absolutely.
So Larry Reagan, it's been a great pleasure having you here. And thank you for being on Science Studio.
Thanks for our producer, Dennis Wu.
We'll be back next week. Bye-bye, and see you soon.